database of 6,500, more than 6,500 facilities against separate databases of flood risk, wildfire risk, and heat risk. And we were able to put them all on this interactive map where you can search most facilities or search individual communities and come up with kind of mini profiles of the facilities with the risk levels that they appear to be facing.
We have to leave it there, but we're going to link to that climate and punishment data map at democracynow.org. Aline Brown, we thank you so much for being with us of The Intercept, a part of this investigative project. Absolutely remarkable. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask. Wearing a mask is an act of love.
This is KBOO Portland.
Good day. You are listening to KBOO FM 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany, and via the World Wide Web, it is KBOO.FM. I am Cecil, and you are listening to More Talk Radio. Today, we are broadcasting. It is the 14th of February in the year 2022. Many people refer to this date as Valentine's Day, and people share signs of devotion and love and caring towards one another. But it is also the anniversary of the admittance of Oregon into the State of the Union. On February 14, 1859, Oregon was admitted into the United States. What was unique about Oregon admittance to the United States? Well, there are probably many things that are unique. But one thing which was unique was that Oregon was admitted into the state, into the United States, as a free state. 1859, the United States was on the cusp of a civil war, and there was a raging debate within the United States about slavery, and there was a debate on territories within territories who were mulling whether or not to become states or not, whether or not they would be admitted as a slave state or as a free state. Oregon was admitted as a free state. The Oregon electorate, and again, it was all white male electorate, voted for Oregon to be admitted as a free state. However, there were some, what should I say, a small clause also was involved in that. Oregon had a history of black exclusion laws from early on when it was a territory in the 1840s and 1850s. Several things were passed forbidding blacks to be admitted to the state, and there were things such as lashing laws, where there was a penalty if blacks were in the state and did not leave, that they were subject to lashing. Now, whether or not that ever occurred, we are not sure. There's no evidence that blacks were lashed because they settled in the state. However, the legacy of that anti-blackness continued throughout Oregon history. And in fact, the founding constitution said that no free Negro or mulatto not residing in this state at the time of the adoption of this constitution shall come, reside, or be within this state, or hold any real estate, or make any contracts. This exclusion law continued, and descendants of Africans were forbidden from participating fully in the affairs of the state of Oregon, forbidden to live indeed. I just lost my transcript, that's why I paused. And it said, continuing, no free Negro or mulatto not residing in the state at the time of the adoption of this constitution shall come, reside, or be within this state, or hold any real estate, or make any contracts, or maintain any suits therein. And the legislative assembly shall provide by penal laws for the removal by public officers of all such Negroes, mulattoes, and all their effectual exclusion from the state, and for the punishment of person who shall bring them into the state or employ or harbor them. Now, this clause in the U.S. Constitution was repealed formally by the voters on November 3rd, 1926. Although a lot of the racist language remained in the Oregon Constitution until the 21st century, when voters voted to remove the racist language from the state in 2002. And yet, fully 30% of the voters voted to keep the racist language. So the history of blacks in Oregon is a one fraught with dispute, with anguish, and with trepidation by many Oregonians. Perhaps because of the anti-blackness which was endemic in the founding of the Oregon territory and the state, the populations of African Americans remain a small percentage from the beginning of the Oregon of white settlement in Oregon until this day. So, on this conversion day of Valentine's, of love, and of the Oregon Statehood Day, we said offer you a chance to call in and talk about how you would like to discuss this. There are a couple of other topics we will discuss, particularly the proposal by top aide of the mayor of of Portland, Sam Adams, the former mayor, who's works for the current mayor, his proposal about homelessness and what they might do for it. It's an 8-page document, which is interesting reading. So give us a call when you can, either talking about whether or not the anti-blackness language and history of Oregon is something we should recognize and address as we reflect on today being Oregon Statehood Day, or other things such as Sam Adams' proposal for how to deal with houselessness in Oregon. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And Molly is on the line. Good morning, Molly. Thank you for waiting.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having the show. And I'd like to just open on a Valentine note of Aaron winning the speed. Aaron, I thought I wrote her last name down. Aaron Jackson, gold medal speed skater in the 500-meter race, the first African-American, obviously, to win this race. And I just happened to turn on and catch that last night, and I was so glad that I did, because I was filled with so much pride. And what struck me is that when I first turned it on after watching a show, there was this fantastic racer, and I thought, this person is going to win the race. Look at that. How this, I knew it was a woman, but I didn't know her color or anything else. And so when she took off the helmet, I was, wow, it's an African-American woman. I just about cried for joy. And they put on the headsets, and her parents, her father said, we knew you had it in you. And it was just the most beautiful moment. But I'm calling because I didn't get in last week, and that show kind of carries over with where you were talking about Whoopi Goldberg and and that whole thing. And I just wrote down a few quick notes, and then I'll get off so other people can talk. But the the word is so powerful, the N-word. And so I would say to go back, instead of banning books like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, to just put the word with a maybe the N dot 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 as a teaching tool to how things were, but not ban the book, because this is such an important thing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get into that word a little bit, but of course this is a word I, as a non-African American person, would never ever use, and not even say in my own household to my closest friend. I would never speak this word. Someone like Dave Chappelle can use it, and I think other African American people can use it as a brotherhood kind of term, and that's okay for them, because that takes away the power of that word for them only, and that's the whole point. It's for them only, and someone who's not of color could not do that. But I also want to say that Ruby Bridges is 62 years old. Mm-hmm. I just saw this on Facebook, actually. I've been posting Black History Month things, I get lots of them. And yes. And Ruby Bridges is only 62 years young. She was the first to attend an all-white public elementary school. It just shows where we're at. I saw another thing. The real reason Music City is named Nashville is called Music City is because Fisk University, which opened in 1866, mm-hmm. was the first American university to let people, irrespective of color, and then they had Jubilee singers that went around when the university was very suffering and needed money. They went around, they raised money around the country, they became quite well known, and they actually went to Europe in 1873. And so Queen Victoria commissioned a floor-to-ceiling portrait of this original group as a gift to Fisk. So they were world-renowned. So when we were talking last week, Joe Rogan's use of the racial slur and all this outrage it's just a cultural thing. And let me just finish by saying I was a teacher at Cleveland High School, and I loved having so many different types of people in my life. I have an African-American friend who, needless to say, he told me he does not feel comfortable driving to the coast, Oregon coast, because it's just there aren't enough people of color around, and he feels nervous to this day. And this outraged me. But anyway, I just want to finish by I'm probably saying too much here, but because I wanted to get a lot in,
sure.
Like the whole thing of plantation sports field by being called that by the players are mostly black and the coaches are always mostly white, and we're in such an amazing place in history with, you know, for instance, the Aaron Jackson winning and the pride that I felt, and what a beautiful young woman. And the difference in culture, that's what I was going to say. I had a African-American student in my class, and when he told me it was his birthday and I was walking by and he was walking by me, I just said, oh, it's your birthday, and I gave him a kiss on the cheek. Well, I could have lost my job, for one thing.
Yeah.
Because you don't even touch students in this day and age. But that was my culture and my family. If it was someone's birthday, you sing them happy birthday, you kiss them on the cheek. Well, he didn't show up in class for 2 weeks. And I said, well, I won't mention his name. And the other student said, well, Miss, you know, my name, Miss, you kissed him on the cheek, and that is not, you know, you could get fired for your job and everything else. So 2 weeks later, he came back, and all was cool. But then on graduation, I didn't end up going because sitting through all that, but the student told me, my dad really wanted to meet you. So I realized somehow I broke through a cultural thing, that it was a moment everyone went back and thought, oh, what did I do? This was not culturally accepted in another culture. But it all turned out okay because it was in the spirit of love, and it's Valentine's Day. I'll leave it at that. Thank you for listening, and hey, I love your show.
Thank you so much, Molly, for calling and sharing.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye now. And you are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Our last caller, Molly, had several things that she spoke about. She began by congratulating Aaron Jackson, who's the first African-American woman to win a speed skating gold medal in the Olympics this weekend, 500 meters. And she joined Shawnee Davis, who was an African-American athlete who won a gold medal in the individual event in speed skating in the 2006 Olympics. Molly also mentioned about whether or not the N-word is not appropriate, and how we navigate this. And she offered a proposal in terms of literature, instead of banning books such as Mark Twain's book, but to publish it, to have it read with the N-word remaining in there, but with exclamation points or asterisks where the word is written. She also mentioned about the debate about who can say it, who cannot say it, and I was intrigued. I happened to see an episode of a new TV program it's called Bel Air, which is a reboot of the 1990s sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel Air. And it's a drama, not a comedy, about what happens about a inner city black youth who is suddenly forced or moved to live with his rich relatives and go into a predominantly white prep school, and what happens when he enters into the locker room and white teenagers are singing a rap song with his cousin, who's also black, but was only one black person surrounded by his teammates who were all white and rapping the song and just saying the N-words back and forth. And whether or not that's appropriate or not. So this is an ongoing debate within society at wide. And she ended her conversation, also mentioned Ruby Bridges, who is in her early 60s, and as a young girl, she was 5 years old. She integrated to a predominantly white school, and that is a story that I know in black households people talk about and remember, because oftentimes we talked about who are the civil rights champions, and oftentimes they are adults and males, and so we often like to include on the role of teenagers and youth, such as in the Birmingham campaign and the children, hundreds of children getting arrested and beaten in water holes, and Ruby Bridges, who was a young girl, 5 years old, who integrated her school. You are listening to More Talk Radio, KBOO FM, and we'll go to our next caller. Mimi, thank you for waiting.
Oh, thank you for having this show today. It's a great show. I wanted to comment on Sam Adams' new suggested policy.
Yes.
And my feeling is that as somebody who's been working with houseless people for years, that first of all, there's been an ongoing, what I call a slow genocide by the city, state, local, and state government. Mm-hmm. Of our houseless population, of our houseless residents. And I say that because we obviously have the money to house everyone, because we have the money to instead create these shelters in general before Sam Adams's, you know, crazy Himmler-like agenda that he just put out. What do we do with the money that we've, you know, all voted for? There's like $911.4 million that we said should go to housing the houseless. Mm-hmm. And affordable housing. None of that money has gone for housing the houseless. Very little of it, has gone for affordable housing. So here we have people who are dying by the hundreds every year on the street. And what do we call this when a city who has the money to house everybody doesn't? Well, to me, as a queer Jewish woman who knows her history, mm-hmm. This is a type of genocide. And yeah. Most recently, with Sam Adams' proposal, it's no longer hyperbole. He's taken a page out of Himmler's final solution, and mm-hmm. he's starting at the beginning. He's starting with internment camps, and yeah. That's what this proposal is. This proposal is to take thousands of people, divide them by the thousands, and load them up into camps. And what no one's talking about when they say, let's just say people who are sick of seeing houseless people, what they're not talking about is what happens when you take people, first of all, who don't want to go into a camp like that, you know, an internment camp. What happens to their addictions? What happens to them when they have no way of feeding their addiction? They're going to die, and they're going to die a terrible, terrible death. Most people have not seen what it looks like when a person cannot get their addiction fed.
Right.
It's horribly painful, and it will kill them. So there's the additional death from that, from housing people. What, the National Guard is going to bring heroin in? I mean, the reality is in prisons, heroin does get into the prison system. It comes in primarily through the guards. So that's what we're going to have? every turn of this agenda that Adams is proposing makes my skin crawl. And yeah. For people who are in the camp of thinking that they're progressive, but think that this is okay because it's not really genocide, because the UN hasn't deemed houselessness as a type of genocide, and therefore it can't be genocide. What that reminds me of is reading the history as World War II, before World War II happened, as the Nazis were gaining their strength, people were like, as the propaganda was going out, oh, this isn't that, this isn't so bad. And that's what I'm hearing from progressive people in this city right now.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'd love to.
No, Mimi, I'm glad that you raised the point, and as a Jewish woman, I'm glad that you, you recognize what, you know, as you suggested, under mild language, is forcing people into camps, and you know, I read the proposal. You know, it's only 8 pages, so it's simple for someone to read. It's not full of technical language, but it is dangerous, as you suggest, in terms of, well, this is a way in which we can protect them. There's a lot of language in there that we're doing this for those who are houseless, and we're protecting them. But the idea of putting, you know, thousands of people in camps with using the National Guard to, I don't know, either protect them. I think the proposals say that they will not be armed, but still, it's certainly made me shudder and stress.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. The fact that Sam Adams had the gall to even write this proposal down was a stunning display of the dystopian state that I feel that we're in right now in Portland, with the issue of fascists coming in on our streets and now fascism rising in City Hall. And that to me is, again, this is not hyperbole anymore. We're talking about internment camps. And until people can actually see what's going on historically here, I don't think there is another way to look at this, right, other than to be not just concerned, but horrified, and to not just stop this plan, because this plan might not go through. But the fact that he had the gall to write it in the first place and share it means that there will be a plan after this plan. They're just going to try to fine-tune it and get more people on board. And that's what happened in the history books.
Yeah. One other thing I would like you to talk about. You began by saying, you know, that there has been allocated millions of dollars to address houselessness, and it has not been done. What do you think that we ought to do about that fact, and how should those funds be directed, or why haven't they been directed to solving the problem of...
I think, from what I've watched over the years, is that if the city wanted to house the houseless, they would. And this is why I continue to call what I see on the streets in relation to what the city is not doing a genocide. This is a planned, it looks to me as if this is a plan. If you have, out of that $911.4 million, money for only affordable housing but not for houseless people, but you have the money to bring in the National Guard, and create a space for three different internment camps, the money that would be going to that would have to come out of that fund, or perhaps it's getting funneled by the Portland Business Association. You know, they're the people who do most of the funding around, especially regarding houseless issues, because they don't want houseless people to be seen, because it's bad for business.
Yeah.
So I think that one of the things that I've been calling for is an audit of JOHS, because that's where the money is. That's where the money from the ballots is.
It's also in Metro.
JOHS?
Yes.
Joint Office of Houseless Services.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Run by Mark Jolin.
Mm-hmm.
This is where a lot of that money is. And Jolin has created the buyback of certain buildings only for affordable housing and only part of affordable housing. So it's been done for houseless people.
Yeah.
That's and on top of COVID and on top of rent issues and on top of the last few years and economic strife, we have so many more people. And I want to remind people that in 2018, I think it was, PSU did a study on how many houseless people we had in this area, and there were 38,000. So this number, this very convenient number of 4,000, is not a real number. PSU's study was real, and if you look up PSU study on how many houseless or the houseless count, it will come up for you.
Okay.
So that was years ago.
Yes. No.
Yeah. So the city's not doing anything except this new crazy idea to intern houseless people and, you know,
right,
watch them die.
Well, thank you so much for calling me, Mimi. And I'd like to say that three of the city commissioners have denounced the plan, but as you said, that it has been written and has been discussed. It's sort of like legitimized the idea and how it might be tweaked or changed is something that we all should be aware of and not let it slip by. Thank you so much
exactly.
for calling. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And you are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO FM. I am Cecil, and our numbers are 503-231-8187. And Robert has been waiting. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. I just want to say that I agree with a lot of the stuff that Mimi's saying, but as a former drug addict myself, I have to say that that being forced to not do drugs is probably not going to kill anybody. I mean, you could say that it's genocide on drug addicts and that their addictions have to be fed. I agree to a certain point with that, but saying that you're condemning those people to genocide is just not the case. I mean, Barry, as a person that's kicked heroin several times and methamphetamines and stuff myself, very few people actually die when they don't get their drugs. And not saying that it's right to ostracize people.
Uh-huh.
I do think that a lot of what's going on is because of the end of the drug war. We used to have laws in place to force people to either go to prison or clean up, get off drugs. And what we're seeing is we don't have any way really, I feel right now, to replace what was being done by drugs being illegal.
Yeah. So what do you suggest a way to move forward?
I think that the best thing to do, you know, is to provide people with their drug of choice.
Mm-hmm.
It would take all the crime off the streets. I know it's nobody really wants to do that, but at the same time, you know, the reason that all the crime is going down is so people can get money for drugs. And I wonder sometimes if we had something in place to taper people off, put them in a place, help them get their teeth fixed, help them learn how to function in society again, provide them with drugs on you know, only if they move forward in their programs to better their lives.
So do you have any thought, you know, where Oregon decriminalized drugs and whether or not that's working or not?
Well, it's a step in the right direction. I don't think that making drugs illegal has really fixed anything. But I, you know, everybody gets so hot about defund the police, but really what we're talking about is diversifying the money that goes to police departments. And there's so many, you know, really, I think if you want to go to rehab right now, you probably have to wait 6 months.
Right. Right.
You need to be able to go to rehab nearly immediately.
Yeah.
You need to be in there for more than 21 days. People go in for 21 days and they come out an OD is what happens.
Uh-huh. Wow.
I almost think that we need to have some kind of camp. And I hate to say camp, but but some kind of programs where people are provided with their drugs, they're taught how to function society again, and at the end of it, you know, I mean, I know so many people that were forced by the prison, by the law, to either go to jail or clean up their acts. And none of them wanted in the beginning to stop doing drugs, but when they were forced to stop doing drugs at the end of the program, or the end of, you know, them getting sober or whatever, they were so happy that somebody forced them to do it.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens, and a lot of jurisdictions are wrestling with this, and I appreciate your call, Robert.
You bet. It's no easy answers. That's why it's such a, you know, a long and difficult problem.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
And have a great day. Yes, you know, Oregon recent example of dropping criminal penalties for those carrying small amounts of heroin, cocaine, or other drugs, and the goal was to spend the money on addiction recovery services. So to treat substance use disorder as a disease rather than as a crime. The jury is still out whether or not this is being effective or not, or how well Oregon is doing with this new approach to approaching drug addictions. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and Edie is waiting. Good morning, Edie.
Hello. I first called to give some people information about what we can do about housing, and then I was listening to the former speaker. Last week, Monday morning at 8 a.m., there were three last-minute meetings at the Oregon legislature in the House and Senate. Kind of seemed like sneak attacks. We didn't have enough warning out to the public in order to sign up in time to register to testify, in which money that voters had chosen to go towards drug treatment and crime prevention are instead redirected to the police. So it's not going to reduce crime. It's not going to help those who are addicted. It's not going to the cause of the addiction, the physical and emotional pain, the hopelessness, the lack of adequate health care, from not having good, appropriate jobs and houses and community, being a target of racist policing, misogyny, this violence. When we address the cause, then we don't have the symptom. And I've learned that Black Panthers and other groups who were being attacked by the CIA and Los Angeles Police Department, bringing in drugs so they could criminalize Blacks, put them in prison, destroy the communities, and stop the economic independence and self-sufficiency, could counter the addiction. And the best way to counter addiction was to be a part of a community that acknowledges your pain and the injustice and gives you solutions. Yes. You can work together to counter the harm. And so through community working together, mutual aid, solving problems, and recognizing the racist, cultural, capitalistic system that would put that in place, empowers and inspires one, gives one a reason to have hope and to make a difference. And so the physical pain is reduced, and the hope and the courage and the encouragement from others helps one do something better instead. Now, yes. What I originally was going to call about was that money from the federal government, county taxpayers, and city taxpayers has gone to supposedly address the houselessness problem in Portland, and giving a lot of money to Home Forward, which I think is a poverty pimp, a middleman taking the money out. And so Home Forward has some federal land that was for white officer housing built in 1948. And that is now Home Forward's peaceful villa, which has 70 units minus the two that were destroyed through a fire. And those 70 households will be made houseless. They will lose their public housing. They'll be going to Section 8 and compete with others, taking away the 70 households of housing of folks who already were on Section 8. I don't see any reason why a landlord would want to take on Section 8. And then these people would lose their public housing, lose their Section 8 housing, and then they would be put onto Section 18, and they would not be able to come back to their home at Home Forward Peaceful Villa on, that's between Division and Powell, between 47th and 46th off of Clinton bike route. And instead of it being one story fourplexes, which are great for senior and disabled people, it would be four, five, six higher story buildings that would just be death traps without electricity, with gasoline explosions, with earthquakes. And this is on liquefaction land, where the land in an earthquake would become like quicksand, would be like liquid.
Hey, Edie, this is
where we need to say stop having your money go that way, but instead have the money go directly into housing. And that housing, instead of it being for Peaceful Villa, being for people who are much, much richer than the people who live here now, that does not allow any housing for the currently unhoused, we could immediately house within a month everyone who is houseless who wants housing, because we have more than 20 times peopleless housing as we have houseless people.
Hey, Edie, this is a lot of information to process, and we don't have enough time to go into all of this that you're sharing with us. And I invite you to call in, and we'll have a program which we can glean your knowledge, because you have a lot of information. So thank you for sharing what you have, and for your passionate analysis of the housing situation and crisis and where we should go in the future. You are listening to More Talk Radio, and I am Cecil, and we have Robert, who's been waiting. Good morning, Rob. Ron?
Hey, Cecil, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I can't really comment on the drug problem. I mean, that's too deep for me, listening to the guy that last talked talking about legalizing heroin and whatever.
Uh-huh.
But as far as homelessness is concerned, the city has a great thing going with the homeless, where the people have the little tiny houses over in Northeast by the airport. I can't think of the name of it. It's been going on for years.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to have a similar project on a larger scale. And they could set aside some land where people who are living in their vehicles, I've seen so many of them up and down Marine Drive and all over in the Northeast, could park and legally, you know, but they just, I don't know why they won't do that. Like they don't do it.
That sounds reasonable. Why not? Why do you think they don't do that?
Now, that's a good question, and I'd like somebody who could answer that question actually answer it. Because, you know, we've got that situation over there in Northeast that's worked great for years.
Yeah.
And they won't enlarge that. You know, it's crazy. You know, it's like they don't care. It's like it's a tactic. And then on top of that, we've got organizations that, you know, you got these secret societies that are dictating what people do, lock, and people are following in their steps, lockstep. They're marching in their. How can I say it? I've known things that they've done, and people are just going along with the program, not saying anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we're on the verge of a Hitlerist state. You know, but people are going along with it. They, you know, it's political, and when politics is involved, people can get away with a lot of things.
Yeah.
I don't know where this society is headed. It's crazy.
Wow.
But I hope we all gain some sense at some point and are able to act on our own and not on, you know, what someone tells us to do or, you know, there's some unwritten rules. There's some things going on below the society, you know, not out in the open. And they need to stop. They need to learn. You know, we need to get back to common sense where we can operate on our own. Yeah. Thanks.
Hey, thank you so much. And I suggest that you keep talking about your suggestions about tiny houses, and maybe someone with power will hear you. Thank you so much for calling. And we'll go to Dempsey, I believe, is on the line.
Yes. Thank you, Cecil, for having me on the air. I want to give you props for bringing this kind of program to the public. And I wanted to speak on the subject of the N-word. Mm-hmm. And firstly, about like the books that have the N-word, I would think it's a good idea to put a footnote in the book. Like, don't get rid of the word, but put a number or an asterisk, and uh-huh. down below, you probably need a lot of footnotes, I would think. The N-word appears in so many books, right? And maybe in all those books, you could have an agreement about, amongst academics or whoever, about like what could be said. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that would look like, but I thought we should like put this word into historical context.
Yes.
And my understanding is every time that word, when people are going to talk about it, they'll point to the Spanish word negro, assuming that like the English speakers learned that word from Spanish slave traders, and uh-huh. that might be true. But I have my own idea. I think it may very well be related to the English word niggardly, uh-huh. the adjective that describes a mean and some kind of word that means you don't want to spend a spendthrift.
Uh-huh.
Just simply because it's an insult that already existed in English.
Yes.
And then the British, wherever they went, they use that word, the N-word, to describe the natives of India that they were colonizing. And they did the same thing when they went to Australia. Australian Aboriginals are called the N-word. This is something, as an American, I didn't realize until I was an adult. I said, wow, because I, you know, as an American, you think that's an American word.
Right.
I'll put this into more context for myself. I grew up in Northeast Portland. I went to Harriet Tubman Middle School.
Uh-huh.
I'm a European American. There are friends of mine, African Americans, who might say to me, "What's up, N-word?" to me,
mm-hmm.
and I might chuckle, but feel uncomfortable, honestly, because I'll have to say, "Well, I can't say that back to you."
Yeah,
I feel like I can't ever use that word unless there's some specific context.
Yeah.
Like, my wife is Kenyan, and our boy is Kenyan, and I'll have discussions with him about like what is life going to be like for you as a black man in America,
mm-hmm.
and like we talked the other day about this word. He goes to a middle school in Salem, mm-hmm. Oregon, and it's diverse.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of Mexican Americans, South Pacific Islanders, uh-huh. and white kids,
uh-huh.
and they throw around that word a lot every day.
Mm-hmm.
N-word this, N-word that, and they went to him. They asked him, "Hey, why don't you use that word?" And he was like, "Cause I don't." But why uh-huh. not? Because I don't like it. I don't feel comfortable. It feels odd, like for him
yes.
and for me to have that conversation about everybody's using this word.
Yeah.
This insult and throwing it around casually when it's serious. It's a serious word.
Right.
And it comes with violence and an ugly history.
Yeah.
And I think as Americans of all colors, we all have to have a truthful, honest, face-to-face reckoning with this word and the history of the word. And we, as a country, have to come to an agreement about how this word is going to be used in education and in public.
Wow. You know, I wish I had recorded what you just said. It's powerful, and in terms of how you, the conversation with your son and the history of the word. I think more people should be as thoughtful. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yes, thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And you're listening to More Talk Radio. This is KBOO. I am Cecil. Coming up next is the OMO Variety Hour. And stay tuned for that programming. You will hear on that hour, great conversations. So stay tuned right here on KBOO. In the meantime, let's go to our next caller, Joan. Good morning, Joan.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I don't know. Well, it's on the housing topic, and I certainly can't. It's hard for me to follow that very thoughtful comment that the last caller made. But I just wanted to say about the housing that it seems kind of obvious to me, even though we do have mental health problems and we have drug problems. The main problem with the housing is that the rent and the cost of housing is too damn high, period. People can't afford it. And I think the problem starts with the real estate industry, which I think is the root of the problem right now. It's not about real estate. It's about a basic human need. And as long as we're thinking of housing as real estate, and as long as we're thinking about it as some kind of investment, you know, there are people from all over the country that are investing in Oregon, meaning they come into this state and buy up huge chunks of it and then start renting it out and calling themselves housing providers.
Yes.
They are not housing providers. They are taking advantage of the situation, which is putting people on the street. Mm-hmm. And from what I can imagine, anyone that's been on the street and living like that for a few years is going to have mental illness problems and might very well turn to drugs and alcohol just to keep themselves in some kind of state where they can stand it.
Yes.
I don't know how anyone can stand it. And I certainly don't have a solution at the moment, but I think we should not be looking at this market rate business. It's not a business. It's a ripoff.
Well,
and that we are being put in the same situation as the Native Americans were put in from the very beginning. The land is being taken from us. There is no common, and there should be.
Yeah.
Nobody should be investing in land anymore. It doesn't work anymore. The system needs to be replaced. And it's a question of land reform.
Yes.
And that's a big one. It's a
yes.
political one.
Yes.
And I don't know what else to say, but if I didn't have, you know, I have some subsidized housing. And if I didn't have that, I would be on the street and I would not survive.
Right.
And I, you know, you see old people laying there looking like somebody's grandma or grandpa. What are they doing on the street?
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford a place to live. I know people with jobs that are on the street.
Yes.
So it's not about having better jobs and more money. The price goes up and up and up. And all it does is reduce the value of the dollar so that our money is worthless. Because if all that, you know, you have $500 and you can't find a place to rent, it means the $500 is worth less than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the house, the little, you know, crappy apartment with bad heating and so on is suddenly worth a lot of money.
No.
And who lives in those million-dollar condos? And why are they there? And that's my rant for today. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your rant. And rant on with that analysis, I think, is so important. I think the rent is too high, and I believe housing should be seen as a right. And your thoughtful remarks about the industry is something that those in power should heed. Thank you so much, Joan.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And you are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. I am Cecil, and we are talking about a wealth of issues with a lot of thoughtful people reflecting on many thoughtful things. So I appreciate reflections on the use of the N-word and reflection on housing, the source of housing. Why is it a crisis? How people have shared their opinions on Sam Adams' proposal of, well, I should use his word, I but camps for up to 3,000 people with National Guard unarmed surrounded them. And also your reflections on how we as a society should live. I appreciate the thoughts of many of our callers shared this morning, Dempsey, Ron, Robert, Joan, and Molly, and I'm leaving out some people as well. Your thoughts are so useful. I think we should continue to generate conversation among ourselves, with our neighbors, with those in our own household, and also direct the attention and your passion and your rage to those in government. Oftentimes where decisions are made, we can have ideas about how effective our governments are, but one thing that I think is reasonably true here in Oregon is how accessible governments and decision makers are. It is simple to talk to your legislator or their aide, to talk to your representatives on city council or the county, and let them know how you feel and what you think that you ought to do. So on this, the 14th of February, where people are talking about love, and love is in a many splendid ways, as some poet said, but also this is the 163rd anniversary of Oregon becoming a state. And what does that mean? What type of state do we want? What type of state do we want to create? As we wrestle through what might seem turning a corner on the pandemic, and with fingers crossed, what do we like to gain from our experience together? How might we be better people? How might we seek ways to address the issues of houselessness, as several of our callers shared their outrage, but also some helpful suggestions about what we should do, offering alternatives to the plans that Sam Adams suggested. What should we do in terms of how do we talk to our children about what words are appropriate, and what books to read, and how should we have those discussions not only with our children but with our school board? So much is happening on local school districts about what books should be read and what books should not be read. What do you think are the ways in which communities can come together to have these discussions that are so important? And as for me, I don't think that we should ban books or limit access to books. We should invite our children, the students, and those teachers and administrators to engage in meaningful, transformative conversations about the way in which books are not only written, but the context, and have those type of discussions. One story, I remember when I was in middle school in eighth grade, and we had to read Catcher on the Rye. And, you know, it's a great book, but in class we had to stand up and read different sections of the book. And I, being such a, you know, such a nerd and never wanted to get in trouble, I remember when it was my turn to stand up and to read a section of the book, when it came to words that I felt uncomfortable with, you know, words that were not nice words to say, that, you know, your parents would wash your mouth out with soap if you said that. When it came to those words, I just passed on those words and read the words after that. My English teacher never said anything to me, nor do I think any of my fellow students did. But I think that was just a reflection of what I thought should be done. But, of course, I wanted to read Catcher in the Rye. So these are things that we wrestle on an individual and a societal level. How do we build a better society? It depends on you and I and those people that we find difficult to talk to and think we have nothing in common. I think that we do have things in common, and we should continue to find common ground. Continue to speak to your neighbor. Continue to listen to KBOO, and stay tuned next for the Omo Variety Hour. Thank you so much for spending time this hour and for all that you are doing to make our world a better place. I am Cecil Prescott, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you, and have a great day.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available.